It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, it's down to the wire for Congress to come to an agreement on NSA surveillance with a big deadline on Monday. We'll discuss the latest in national politics.
First, a bill calling for the repeal of the state's prevailing wage law got a public hearing today in the Assembly's Labor Committee and could soon be heading for a full floor vote.
The 84-year-old policy sets a minimum wage for construction workers building publicly funded projects. Supporters of a change say the law inflates wages and makes those projects more expensive. Opponents are worried a repeal could mean the scaling back of wages.
Here with us now to talk about today's hearing on the bill is Patrick Marley, state capitol reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, first off, let's talk about what the prevailing wage law is. How do you define it?
So it's, as Rob was just saying, it's a minimum wage essentially for publicly funded projects that reach certain thresholds and how much they cost. So you're building a highway, you're building a school. If it costs enough, then you have to look at a wage study for what construction workers are paid on other projects and pay them at least that amount.
Now, this is a law that has been on the books in Wisconsin for a long time. Why is it being looked at by Republican lawmakers now?
Republican lawmakers say that it artificially inflates the market, that they should put out a bid, that construction companies can come in, they can determine the labor rate, and then the schools or the highway department, whoever's building the project, will take the lowest bid and can get some savings for taxpayers that way.
So it's being looked at right now as a money-saving measure by Republicans?
Yes, that's what they say. They also, I think, oppose it on principle, that they say the market should be able to set its own market rates. But they're seeing what they consider significant savings for taxpayers. Opponents of this say you get a race to the bottom, and the last place you want to skimp on a public project is on the quality of work. Otherwise, you could have, you know, significant structural problems, and that if you're paying good wages, you can help middle-class jobs, and you can also ensure quality work.
Now, one question about this is repeal it for Republicans or rewrite it, and the Senate's Labor Committee took up the topic of repealing that law, but that effort failed. What happened?
So, yeah, there's a significant wing of Republicans who want to just repeal it outright. Legislative leaders have said they don't have the votes for it, and so that they would rather rewrite the law. Essentially, that would mean raise the threshold at which the prevailing wage law is triggered, so smaller projects wouldn't come into the prevailing wage law. Senator Nass from Whitewater said he wanted to move forward on this. He held a hearing and a vote on it in his labor committee in the Senate earlier this month, but one of his Republicans on the committee joined the Democrats and opposed it. And then Nass came up with an alternative that would have raised those thresholds. Howard Markland from Spring Green, the Republican, also joined Democrats in opposing that. And so it died at that stage, though it can come back at any time to the floor if Republicans in general agree on it. Today, Representative Andre Jacques in the Assembly is taking a similar tack. Despite his leadership's opposition to this bill, is holding a hearing on it as we speak, and will hold a vote on it this evening or this afternoon. And that very well could clear the committee, at which stage Republican leaders, if they chose, could advance it to the floor of the Assembly.
We're talking right now to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Patrick Marley. We're talking about today's public hearing on ending the state's prevailing wage law. And Patrick, one question mark has been, where is the governor on this? Has he been actively involved, and what is his support level? What do we know about
that? Today his office is saying that he would sign it and that he's been working for weeks to either reform the prevailing wage law or to repeal it. There's been a big push from conservatives to try to get this enacted, and that's included pressure on Republican leaders in the legislature, and they shifted the focus a little bit to Governor Walker today. Jerry Bader, who's a conservative talk show host in Green Bay, wrote a column for RightWisconsin.com that called Walker the invisible man on this issue and said that he should be able to come out and say where he is on this issue within hours. The governor did that by saying he supports the repeal of prevailing wage. So that gives momentum to the folks who want to pull it back.
So Republicans who are less than sure about this, like Howard Markline, are they more interested in backing it if this is a rewrite of the law instead of a repealing of the law?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, Markline had a chance to vote on a rewrite of the law and opposed it. Now, there could be other ways that you change the law. You know, that was just one version of rewriting the law. it's certainly possible that they can come up with some kind of compromise that would get his vote and the votes of other Republicans. If they go short of a full repeal, it's a difficult balancing act, because you've got people like Markline who don't want it to go too far, and you've got proponents of repealing who are worried about sort of a fake compromise or something that Republicans can publicly cheer, but that really doesn't make enough change to the law as what they want to see. So it's a tough balancing act for everybody.
So what determines whether this law, whether it's repealed, rewritten, ends up in the budget or ends up on the floor?
So I think that most people are expecting it to be resolved one way or the other in the budget. If they don't include it in the budget, it would be even harder to pass as standalone legislation. And the budget committee is sort of in its final stages this week. So really what the proponents of it are hoping is that they can build momentum for it and then have it inserted into the state budget. It's a lot easier for lawmakers to vote on a change like that if it's in the budget, because they can go out and tell people they voted for it, but only because they liked other things in the budget and they didn't like that particular element that was in the budget.
Now, Wisconsin recently became a right-to-work state. Do we know whether other states are also moving in this direction, repealing similar laws to the prevailing wage law?
Yes. Indiana just this month repealed a similar law. It's got a different name in Indiana, but so that's sort of the clearest sign of this. And I think, you know, you take this in conjunction with right to work and things like Act 10 and what Ohio did or nearly did with public workers in that state. It's something in the last few years that there's been pressure from Republican legislatures on union laws or laws that are helpful to unions in transforming those.
And Patrick, before we let you go, what kinds of things are people saying at the hearing today?
Well, it's pretty similar to what we heard on Right to Work. It's the same folks that are showing up. And, you know, you've got the advocates for it saying this is savings to taxpayers and that we shouldn't be inserting ourselves into the market. The government shouldn't be. And supporters of it saying this is a good way to make sure we get quality work and to make sure that middle-class jobs are protected.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was reporter Patrick Marley of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about today's public hearing on ending the state's prevailing wage law. We head to Washington for our weekly look at the top headlines in national politics. Congress is on recess, but that hasn't stopped lawmakers from continuing to negotiate a bill that would modify the NSA's authority to collect bulk phone data. That provision of the Patriot Act expires this Monday, June 1st.
And yesterday, a federal appeals court panel denied a White House request to move forward with the president's plan to grant work permits and quasi-legal status to millions of undocumented immigrants.
Here with us now to talk about all that and more is Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent for the Daily Mail. Francesca, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So what does Congress have to work through between now and this coming Monday on the Patriot Act before parts of it pertaining to NSA surveillance expire?
Well, first of all, the Senate has to pass any legislation dealing with it at all if they do not want it to expire, as you just said. In a marathon session that ran into Saturday morning even, they couldn't come to an agreement on this issue and eventually left town for their holiday, even though it will expire on Sunday, without passing any legislation. So there's several different roads and paths that they could take to get it passed, but they have to do something.
Now, the president has been urging Congress to get cracking on this, as you said, that they recessed, though. But what parts of the Patriot Act is he most concerned about expiring?
Well, the most important one is Section 215, which is where the NSA derives its power in order to look at bulk telephone records of Americans. Now, what they do when they look at these records isn't so much have a name attached to it and go through your personal data. What happens is all this information is fed into a system, and then they look at phone numbers associated with known terrorists and run those through the system as well. And so if someone has been in contact with a terrorist, they'll know. And currently, that will expire, that authority, on Sunday at midnight. Now, the interesting thing about that, though, is that a federal court recently ruled that Section 215 of the Patriot Act doesn't even give the NSA the authority to run that program. So it's debatable that even if this section expires, that the administration wouldn't still run the program. But the White House refused to comment on that yesterday.
Well, is Congress looking at modifications to it then, maybe taking it out of government hands?
That's exactly what the Congress is looking to do. The House has already passed legislation that would essentially do just that. It's called the USA Freedom Act. And what it would do is it would put that power back in the hands of the telephone companies, and the NSA would have to get a warrant from a secret court in order to search through that data when it needs to. However, that legislation has stalled in the Senate. The Senate is 3 votes short of overcoming a procedural hurdle that would allow that legislation to formally come up for a vote. So if senators who support the bill are able to turn 3 of their colleagues in favor of just voting, you know, to let it to move forward, not necessarily even voting for the legislation itself in the end, then this will all be resolved on Sunday afternoon.
Now, how likely does that seem to you?
I think it's possible. There, again, are several senators who may be more in favor of having, you know, the same Patriot Act Section 215 reauthorized. However, they may come to the conclusion that they're not going to be able to get that passed, and their best bet to allow the NSA to continue to have these tools legally would be to pass the USA Freedom Act. But it's really tough to say because the Senate's in recess right now.
And so what happens come Monday if there's not an agreement?
Well, the White House has said that the NSA and the Justice Department are already starting currently to wind down those programs in order to come in compliance by midnight on May 31st. So you're already, you know, seeing the effects of what will be happening. It won't just all of a sudden switch off on Sunday.
Now, moving on to the president's immigration plan, a federal appeals court panel ruled that the Obama administration could not proceed with their immigration plan while it's being challenged in court. Unpack that for us a little. What does that ruling mean?
Well, more or less, it just stops the president from being able, and the Department of Homeland Security, from being able to move forward with the program, as you just said. So it's not a ruling that says what the president did with his executive order, saying that illegal immigrants, that children who came here, you know, as illegal immigrants, they can't stay. That's unconstitutional what he did. What the court said was that he can't move forward with those plans to not deport those certain people until a final court ruling has been made. So this could potentially not be resolved all the way until the Supreme Court and possibly beyond President Obama's administration.
And looking at the big picture issues here, Republicans saying that Obama has overstepped his prosecutorial discretion. What is their case on that?
Well, essentially, they're saying that the president does not have the authority in order to issue sweeping mandates like the one that he did that said that millions of children who came here, you know, were illegal immigrants when they came here, are able to stay. At the same time, the White House is saying that he is absolutely able to do that because it's not just that he's saying that they can't be deported. It's not that he's giving them amnesty. He's specifically saying that you should deport first all sorts of other classes of illegal immigrants, and most importantly, criminals. And if the federal government focused on deporting the criminals first, as well as all the other illegal immigrants, you know, roughly 6 million other illegal immigrants, they would never get to the class of illegal immigrants, the so-called dreamers that his executive order and mandate applies to.
What kind of reaction have immigration reform advocates had to this ruling today?
Well, I think that they're in a little bit of denial about this. They're saying that, you know, this isn't a big deal, that the ruling wasn't based on the merits. You know, all that they said was that Texas and the other states have standing to sue the administration. However, it is a big blow because even to say that the states have standing to sue the administration, you know, says that they do have some sort of a legitimate argument to sue the president. So that could give a look into what will finally happen. Every single court that this has come through so far, this specific case, you know, has essentially ruled the same way.
Now, this ruling from the appeals court was largely technical. When does it look like the actual substance of the immigration case will go before a higher court?
Well, it depends on how the Obama administration decides to play it. They could, you know, take it through another lower level court, so to speak, or they could challenge all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court could choose to take up such legislation as early as their next term next fall, you know, and that wouldn't, however, be heard until the spring, and that wouldn't be decided until the summer, which is why I said that this could potentially take up almost the rest of the president's administration.
We're talking right now to Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent at the Daily Mail, about the latest in national politics. And moving on to the 2016 presidential race, Rick Santorum announced today that he's running for president again this time around. And we haven't heard that much about him so far. Is he being seen as a serious contender?
Well, I think it's hard to hear about many of the 16 Republicans running because there are just so many of them. We counted at the Daily Mail 16 that will probably jump into the race. So I'd be surprised if most of your listeners had heard very much about anyone beyond, you know, Scott Walker from Wisconsin or some of the other bigger names that are expected to jump into the race. You know, Rick Santorum, I think the key things to know about him is he's very, very conservative. He's a former U.S. senator and a member of Congress who lost his 2006 bid for re-election. Since then, he's written a couple books. He started a political action group, and he ran for president in 2012. He was the runner-up in that race to Mitt Romney, falling short in the end. And since then, you know, he's basically spent his time, like I said, traveling the country, promoting his books, and spending a lot of time in early presidential states. However, even though he's had theoretically the most time since, you know, he's not a full-time politician anymore to have been launching his bid, he's still way down low in the polls. And part of the reason, again, I think that is because it's such a crowded field.
Now, he's being seen as someone who's looking to court so-called lunchbox voters or lunchbox Republicans. What do we know about what his platform might be?
Well, first of all, he's going to call for, you know, a revival of manufacturing. Today, his kickoff campaign will be held at a manufacturing, factory in Pennsylvania. He's all about, you know, the blue collar workers, but he is also very, very, very pro-life. And so you'll be hearing him talk about traditional marriage. He is very against abortion. I think you'll hear just as much about the social issues from someone like Rick Santorum as you're going to hear about the economic issues. But the question is, do you agree with his stances on those social issues?
As you were just talking about the Republican pool, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. Is it unusual to see this many candidates in a race, especially this early?
I feel that this is unusual. I wouldn't say this early. You know, I think that there's a lot of years, even if you look back to 2012, there were a lot more candidates who ended up dropping out before we ever got to Iowa, even in January of 2012. But I will say that this is still an unusually large field. I think that the first Republican debate will help to weed out some of these candidates. Only 10 will be allowed on the stage. And anyone who's not in that first debate will have a very difficult time getting attention, I think, in some of these early states, as well as nationally, if they're not on that stage. And even the second debate, only the top competitors will be on the stage the first hour. It's only the second hour that everyone would be on the stage. And that gives them very little time to make a splash and really get their name out there. So I definitely say that in August, the first debate, in September, the second debate, you'll probably see some people dropping like flies.
Who's looking particularly vulnerable to you?
Well, it's Rick Santorum, for one. The way that the rules currently stand, he wouldn't make it into the debate if Donald Trump were to also run. He would really need to knock off Rick Perry as one. Rick Perry is right in front of him as well to get into that debate. Or potentially have another candidate who's polling slightly higher, say a Chris Christie, who's double him in the polls, but double isn't that big of a deal when, let's say, Rick Santorum is, you know, 2.5% and Chris Christie is, you know, 5.5%. He could still make that jump up once he announces his candidacy. He might get a bump even, you might see in the next couple weeks. But still, it will be very difficult, I think, for Rick Santorum and some of these other candidates at the bottom to be able to get into that debate at this point.
Some interesting conversations, interesting statements going on the trail. Rand Paul seems like he's stirring up the mud puddle. He said this morning that it was Republican hawks like John McCain and Lindsey Graham who are responsible for the creation and growth of ISIS. What do you make of a statement like that?
You know, one way that Rand Paul is separating himself from the rest of the field is that he has a very different view on foreign policy than some of the other candidates who are running. Now, in most of those statements, he doesn't specifically say who he's talking about, but anyone who's a close observer of politics knows that he's talking about 2008 Republican nominee John McCain, who's chairman of the Armed Services Committee in the Senate, and is a close ally of Lindsey Graham, also on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Now, Lindsey Graham is also expected to enter the presidential race within the next week. So Paul is really positioning himself against those sorts of people in the race. And not just Lindsey Graham, you know, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio. There are several of them that I would say are on the other end of the spectrum when it comes to military intervention. And Paul is just really trying to make it sharply clear, you know, how he would be different than everybody else who's running.
And just briefly as we wrap up, Francesca, how important are these foreign policy questions going to be in 2016?
Not every year is a foreign policy election. You know, in 2008, that wasn't a foreign policy year, and John McCain was a foreign policy candidate and ended up being an economic year, which helped Barack Obama clinch the general election. But this year, foreign policy could play a huge role as the fight against ISIS continues, as the agreement with Iran goes on. There are several huge foreign policy issues that I think will continue to take center stage, not just this year, but through the 2016 election itself.
Francesca, thanks a lot for talking today.
Thank you again for having me. It's always a pleasure.
That was Francesca Chambers, White House correspondent at the Daily Mail, talking with her about the latest in national politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. According to a recent New York Times article, some major presidential candidates on both sides of the aisle are steering clear of the phrase middle class in their campaign language. Phrases like everyday Americans, hardworking Americans, and ordinary Americans are filling the void.
And that may not be a random word choice, but instead a conscious campaign strategy. As people are starting to see the phrase middle class as a symbol of anxiety, there's concern about income inequality and debt and personal fears that people can't afford the American dream. Sociologists and others say middle class status is something people are afraid of losing instead of a hope for the future.
Michelle Dickerson joins us now for a look at the changing meaning of the phrase middle class and the changing prospects for people in that socioeconomic group. She's the Arthur L. Moeller Chair in Bankruptcy Law and Practice at the University of Texas at Austin, and she writes about issues facing the middle class. Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So I can say middle class, and 50 different people might define it 50 different ways. What are some of the ways that we try to pin down this concept of the middle class?
Well, one thing that we shouldn't do is to use the term income. But when we historically have thought of middle class, we've thought of certain staples. Do you own a home? Do you have a safe, stable, secure job that you can depend on having for a number of years, and that will give you probably you'll get a raise? Can you put your kids through college without either you or your kids plunging into debt? Can you retire comfortably? Those are the things that we typically have associated with the middle class.
And in the way people think of it themselves, you've written that pretty much everyone who thinks of themselves as not rich but not poor thinks of themselves as middle class. That's a pretty big group, isn't it?
Well, and really the way that we should look at it is the middle class is everybody but the very rich. Because most people, if you talk to them, would say, I'm not poor, but I'm also not rich. And so what that leaves is the middle class. But you're absolutely right. That's probably 90% of Americans.
Well, let's get to the idea of middle class status as a source of fear and anxiety. And it seems like where a lot of the anxiety is coming from is, you mentioned income on the one hand and these markers of middle class identity on the other, the home ownership, sending kids to college and the other stuff. Are we at a point where a lot of people have the mismatch? They think of themselves as middle class. Their income doesn't sustain those middle class markers anymore.
Exactly. And if you look at even the way that the middle class is defined by income, if you just looked at the sort of the government sources, the census data, the median income is $53,000. But if you look at the way that certain research institutes or even the media defines middle class, it's between $40,000 and $120,000. Again, that's a huge gap. It makes sense, though, because a lot of the things that people have associated with the middle class, a lot of the markers, are they sort of watch them slipping out of their reach. So home ownership rates are at their lowest in 20 years. Although the unemployment rates are down from the recession, many of the jobs that are being formed now are the low-wage, low-skilled jobs in the retail and the service sector. So the middle class used to be, a lot of folks that were in the middle class had what I would characterize as high-wage, low-skilled jobs. So if you think of sort of the manufacturing jobs that used to be throughout the Midwest and also in sort of the Pennsylvania steel area, a lot of those jobs and the income, it's just gone.
So is this a growing reality that people are faced with a choice if they want to keep these middle class markers going, the home, the college, the vacations? They have to choose between letting some of them go or living with more and more debt than they might have previously.
Well, they certainly have to live with more debt, but sadly, I don't think it's becoming really a choice anymore. Even people that would like to have high wage, low skill jobs, they're not going to get them in most instances because those jobs are just gone. Wages, except for the very top earners, have been stagnant for about 30 years. The wages just haven't kept pace with inflation. For people that are thinking in terms of, you know, college for their kids, the good news is a lot of the elite schools, sort of the Ivy, Stanford, MIT, those types of schools, they're now making college relatively inexpensive for people who I think we could characterize as the middle class, middle income. So a lot of the Ivy League schools will allow children who come from families that earn, you know, sort of $50,000 to $60,000 a year or less to go to college for free. The problem is the person that's earning $100,000 says, but look, I can't afford to put my kids, send my kids to college either. What about me?
We're talking to Michelle Dickerson from the University of Texas at Austin about the changing concept and reality of the middle class in the United States. Maybe growing anxiety over whether people in the middle class can stay there and keep up the lifestyle usually associated with it. You can join in with your thoughts, experiences, and questions at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. So, Michelle, that New York Times article we started by referring to says people are feeling maybe more anxiety when they hear middle class than what we used to think, you know, hope, something to aspire to. Do you think that psychologically middle class is becoming a term of fear and anxiety for us?
I think for a lot of people it's a terrifying term because they've always felt they were in the middle class, but when they hear the term, they realize, I'm slipping out of the middle class. And again, if you think, if most people put themselves in the not poor, not rich, I'm in the middle class, a lot of the people that are slipping from the middle class only see that they're now slipping into the I'm becoming poor. And that's terrifying to a lot of people. And so when you hear the term middle class, they're saying, I'd love to be in the middle class the way it was 30 or 40 years ago, but that's disappearing now, and there's a lot of anxiety that's wrapped up and associated with that term now.
And the trajectory we think of for the American dream is, you know, I did okay, my kids are going to do a little better, their kids are going to do a little better, and so on down the generations. Is there a sense now, you think, that that's not a given, that people are worried their kids are not going to have the same opportunities they do?
It's not a given, and people have reason to be concerned. Upward mobility, as we've known it in the United States, at least as we knew it for, you know, a couple of hundred years, it doesn't really exist anymore. So when you look at the children of sort of the middle class, they go to college, so they, you know, they do well in high school. They go to college, they graduate from college, and they are facing a labor market that may not give them a full-time job that gives them benefits. The jobs that they receive, and I say job plural because a lot of students who are graduating from college are now having to take more than one job to get the same income that their parents got when they had one job. So the students are graduating with a couple of jobs, and they still can't afford to be out on their own. So you have college students who are boomeranging and coming back and living, you know, in their parents and their parents' basements, maybe going back to the room that they grew up in when they were in high school. So parents are worried, and there's good reason for them to be worried.
Now, those candidates we started off talking about want to be able to say, we can help the middle class or working Americans or ordinary Americans, whatever they want to call them. You've written in a piece earlier this year, actually, it's actually hard to target policies that help the middle class people who need it. Sometimes things intended to do that help wealthier people instead.
Yeah, and sort of the best example was a quick comment that President Obama made in the State of Union Address when they were floating the idea of making sort of slight modifications to the college savings plans, which are typically referred to as the 529 plans. overwhelmingly the people that are saving in these tax-preferred college plans are people who we generally wouldn't define as middle class. These are people that are earning $150,000 and higher. So in his attempt to provide some sort of relief to the people that are earning, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, he infuriated people that were trying to save for college, even though these people earned $150,000, $200,000. So good intentions really backfired in that case.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Jim on the line in Tomahawk. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to comment. We just had a discussion of this before we left work, bunch of guys, and we were talking about, and let me put this out there, we're all high-skilled labor. The market today for carpenters, there's the amount of money that you make, the hourly rate, has gone down over the last 15 years. It's the lowest paying job as a carpenter I've ever had. And they're just not there. Like, the jobs aren't there. But what we were commenting on is how none of us can afford a brand-new truck. You know? I mean, we all are responsible men. We go to work. We come home, you know, we live responsible lives, and not one of us there could afford a truck. And we all make, you know, between $18 and $24 an hour. And how now, you know, 20 years ago, you could afford a new truck, or 15 years ago. And it just all seems out of reach.
Yeah. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Michelle, a skilled tradesperson there, once upon a time, I think that would be a thing where you could afford the truck, send the kids to school. Maybe not so much anymore.
Yeah, he's a member of the disappearing middle class. It's the person that has a job. And he said, you know, I get up every day. I go to work. I work hard. He probably works at least 40 hours a week. But he's being paid less than he would have been paid 30 years ago. And, you know, the comment that I made earlier, wages just haven't been going up for anybody except for the very rich. And so I think his name is Jim. Jim and lots of other people, you know, I'm doing the right thing. I go to work, and I can't even afford to get a new truck. You know, he didn't say I want to go out and buy this big, you know, 4,000-square-foot McMansion. He just wants to be able to buy a new truck. And things like that that were markers of the middle class, again, they're just disappearing, which is why you see a lot of the anxiety and the frustrations.
Jim, thanks for the call. We're talking to Professor Michelle Dickerson from the University of Texas at Austin, talking about the changing prospects for middle-class America and the uncertain meaning of what it means to be middle-class.
And you can join the show. What does it mean to you to be middle-class? Is it the income, or is it a lifestyle or a values thing? Do you consider yourself to be middle-class? Are you worried that you might not be able to afford the lifestyle in the future, or that your kids might be worse off economically than you are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now about the changing meaning of the term middle class in the United States and its shift from a status people aspire to one they fear losing. Michelle Dickerson stays with us. She's a professor of law at the University of Texas, Austin, and she's written about the changes and challenges facing middle class America.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself middle class? Are you worried you're not able to afford the things we usually associate with middle class status, home ownership, sending kids to college, that kind of thing? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Michelle, before we go back to our callers, solutions. A lot of people, politicians, think tanks, professors, and others are trying to figure out how to turn things around here. Where do you think the answers might lie, if any?
Well, one place, because I've written a lot about home ownership, one place that I think we have to completely change in terms of our American public policy is how we view housing. We really have to develop housing policies that don't focus exclusively on everybody has to own their own single-family detached home. The housing market still has not recovered in most regions since the recession, and what we're seeing now are people who can't afford to buy a home, but they also can't afford the rents because the rents are increasing because so many people are renting now. So one place where we have to start in terms of sort of the core of what the American dream used to be is to redefine what we mean when we say that, you know, you have secure housing.
We'll go back to our callers now. Heather is on the line in Sun Prairie. Heather, hi.
Hi. Hey, I had to call in when I heard this. We're leaving the country, my family. We're done. I'm what I'd like to call the high-skill, low-wage. I have a master's degree, and I'm a teacher, but I really don't make very much money. I barely make it into what's considered middle class by the government on my own. And I've got a son that is graduating from high school, and my husband is Portuguese, and we're moving to Portugal because college tuition is public. It's free. We don't have to go into debt. As we are looking towards getting older, also health care is covered by the country. And I think that my kids will have a much better chance at being successful living in Europe than they will in the United States. We've given up.
Wow. Heather, thank you so much for calling and sharing that story. So reversing hundreds of years of immigration from Europe to here. I don't know if Heather is the norm, Michelle, but I mean, do you think people will start looking to move, whether within the country or beyond, to try to find these opportunities?
I think they will, and especially one of the interesting things, because she said a lot of interesting things, but one of the things that Heather said is sort of the timing. You know, my son is graduating from high school. So a lot of people may choose to remain where they are and to kind of, you know, slog it out and do the best they can until either their kids are at a point where they're movable or their kids are at a point where the kids are sort of on their own, and then there will be mobility. One of the things that's happened in the last 15 years, I'd say, and it's somewhat tied into housing, is that we've become somewhat less mobile as homeowners. Because people are living in their homes, the homes aren't worth what they owe on the homes in terms of the amount of mortgage. So they can't move to another city or state or region in the United States because they're trapped to the home. And given the way the labor markets are, people are going to have to be willing and able to move to wherever the jobs may be.
Talking to Michelle Dickerson from the University of Texas about middle class status in the United States, changing ideas, a decline of the middle class, and anxiety about that status. Back to our callers now with Michael on the line in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi. I made a couple of points. One thing, of course, yes, good paying jobs are disappearing. I worked my whole life. I'm 69 years old. I worked my whole life as a tool and die maker. It was a pretty decent paying job throughout my whole career, a lot of overtime. But you know what? On the other hand, the expectations of the middle class have gotten way out of control. What people think middle class people or working class people should be able to afford. You know, the expectations for the $300,000 five-bedroom house and the big acre lot or whatever in the suburbs and a bunch of fancy cars that have every option available. And a person earlier mentioned a truck. You know, you can still buy a truck for very inexpensive truck, but now everybody wants a $45,000 or $50,000 truck that has all these. They're not even trucks anymore. And I think that's part of the problem. Expectations got way out of control, and we've got a generation coming up right now that's looking for a lifestyle that unattainable. You know,
Michael, I want to jump in and give our guest a chance to chime in on this. So Michael's saying, yeah, the jobs are going, but also our expectations of what middle class life should look like have gotten out of whack. Do you agree, Michelle?
Somewhat. And there's a timing problem, though. I guess that would be my one quibble. I think the expectations jumped around the 1970s, 80s, early 90s. What we weren't paying attention to during that period was that wages had stopped increasing. No one anticipated the severity of the recent recession. And so just as people had become accustomed to a higher lifestyle in the middle class, all of the things that we needed to sustain the middle class were disappearing. The one thing I totally agree with, though, are what I refer to as the McMansions. What we now expect to be a bare necessity in our homes in terms of square footage, it has become, at least in some areas, quite unreasonable.
Well, Michelle, before we wrap up, the point we started with these presidential candidates avoiding, in some cases, using the phrase middle class, maybe it's just savvy politics, but are you worried that maybe it's a sign that they might not be confronting these problems head on?
I don't think they are confronting them head on, because if they wanted to confront the problems head on, what they would do is say the top 10% and everybody else, because that's really what we're talking about. Most people in the country haven't received wages, haven't received raises for the last, 10, 20, 30 years. The top 10% and especially the top 1 to 2%, they're doing just fine. Their retirements are stable. They don't have to worry about losing their homes. They can buy any truck that they want to. But the reality is the politicians can't alienate them because that's who their financial political backers are.
All right, Michelle, thank you so much for joining us. And by the way, stay dry down there in Texas.
Thanks a lot. I'll try.
That was Michelle Dickerson, law professor at the University of Texas, Austin. I've been talking about the changing meaning of middle class economics and identity here in the United States. And you can keep this conversation going. Just head on over to the Central Time Facebook page. You can share your thoughts and maybe your story over there. We talk a lot about divisive politics here on Central Time. Now there's an interesting online conversation going on about divisive foods. It's over at Food 52. We've talked to some of their writers on our regular Food Friday segment.
And they've been asking their readers to share the most polarizing foods, the ones that people seem to love or really hate. Some of the entries include Brussels sprouts, cilantro, and anchovies.
Brussels sprouts I can do as a sometimes food. I like them okay.
It's a Thanksgiving food.
Right. But in my house, the divisive food is the beets. And this is in my family in general. I like them. Nobody else in my immediate household will touch them.
And sweet potatoes, too, for you, right?
Sweet potatoes. Nobody hates them. They're all mad. They want. Yeah. I mean, they don't go for them. But beets are the great divider. And it goes back. My mom doesn't like them. My grandma loves them. So back and forth through the generations, I guess.
Right. Same with beets with my mom. She has a seminal why I hate beets story that we cannot order anything with beets, and so that's off limits, although I really kind of like them. I hate raw onions. Cooked onions, fine. Uh-huh. Raw onions, not good. And raw celery.
See, I like raw celery okay. I love it in soup. But yeah, that's another one nobody else in my family will touch. Well, how about you? Share your love it or hate it food. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Interested in seeing what your most divisive food ever is.